I'm Brandon Sedloff, the host of the Distribution Podcast. I've been humbled by your support. Every day, I get emails, text messages, LinkedIn messages from listeners around the world. I started this podcast a little over a year and a half ago as a way to codify and share interesting conversations that I'm having with industry leaders across private markets. I figured I'm very fortunate that I get to have these conversations, and every time I learn so much, so I might as well hit record, create a platform so that I can share the learnings with all of you. None of this would be possible without the support of Juniper Square. For the last 10 years, Juniper Square has been powering the investment operations of private markets across real estate, private equity, venture capital, crypto, and more. And Juniper Square's earned the trust of more than 2,000 investment managers around the world that we support with a global team of nearly 600 across our fund administration and technology businesses. If you have a fund that you're thinking about launching, have a fund administrator that you work with that's not meeting your needs, or maybe you just want to learn more about what it would look like to outsource some of these functions for the very first time, but you also want to ensure that you're maximizing the efficiency of your business and you're creating a leading world-class experience for your investors, then drop me a line, brandon_thedistribution@junipersquare.com, and I'll personally make sure a member of our team gets in touch. Thank you for listening and for your support of this podcast, and enjoy the episode.
Genuinely, who are you and what do you want to do? And, you know, what is your company? And don't try to think like, oh, I got to tell the institutional guys this because they want growth, right? It's like, it's so easy to see someone just comes in and they say, hey, we've been doing A, B, and C, but we want to do X, Y, and Z because that's what you want. And it's like, wait a minute, that's not what I want. I want you guys to do A, B, and C and do it well. And if there's great opportunity there, you know, tell me about it. If there's not, you know, maybe we'll build a relationship and we can speak in 3 or 4 or 5 years when there is opportunity. So be true to yourself, understand your company. Don't try to outthink the institutional investor. It just comes off funny. And even if you do somehow succeed on that line, you'll end up in a very unnatural position for you and your team and, you know, find yourself in a funny situation.
Welcome back to The Distribution by Juniper Square. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff. On today's episode, I sit down with Matt Kaplan, Managing Partner of Almanac Realty Investors, a leading investment management firm focused on making investments in independent real estate firms seeking capital to fuel further growth. We discuss the evolution of Almanac, platform and GP stakes investing, and what Matt and his team look for in organizations they partner with. As the investment management industry evolves, especially in real estate, platform and GP stakes investing are becoming more common. Matt and his team at Almanac are pioneers and leaders in this space. Let's get into it. Matt, welcome to the show.
Brandon, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
I'm excited to dig in. There's a lot to talk about, but can you start by introducing yourself and a little bit about the organization that you're a part of for our guests that may not be familiar to set the context?
Sure, would love to. So I'm Matt Kaplan. I'm a team group head, Almanac Neuberger Berman. I've been at the company and its predecessors for over 3 decades on the investment team. So longstanding employee and very deeply involved in the activities of the company. I've been portfolio manager of our flagship fund since 1996. So longstanding there as well. And have been team group head or managing partner since 2009. In that role, I'm chairman of the investment committee and responsible for all things Almanac, which is a very broad mandate. It's, of course, investing and running an investment team that is oriented at, of course, providing investment returns, but also working well together, building a good culture, building a happy culture, working with our investors. Same thing there. We, of course, provide them with returns, but there's so much more in being partners with institutional LPs, as most folks know. And then everything else related to the brand. We were acquired by Neuberger Berman over 4 years ago. So working within that context, seeing how we can leverage off of their resources, being part of the partnership committee here. So a very broad mandate, very interesting, very challenging, but very exciting, but all oriented at our core mission of providing our investors with attractive returns as they've entrusted us with their irreplaceable capital. So that's a little bit of background on me and the firm from an investing point of view, where we'll spend a lot of time on this, but we've been investing, of course, as a firm in real estate since 1981, but for the last 30 or so years into platforms and companies and have done so in a very expansive way. We have a flagship series that I mentioned, the Almanac Realty Securities, that's been oriented at operating platforms. And when I say real estate company, these are entities that own a lot of real estate, but also own the service businesses, employ the people, have a board of directors, and have been, you know, operating, you know, very much the way a company would outside of real estate. They have strategies, they have, you know, plans, they have tactics, and they have certain corporate-like structures. And so over the years, we've done just under $8 billion of commitments into those types of companies, and 50 in number. And also of late have started to invest in GPs, buying minority stakes, which is a new and interesting business, both for the markets and for ourselves. So that's a little bit on me, a little bit on what we do every day at the company. And, you know, it's an introduction to Almanac.
I appreciate that. 30 years at one place is a long time, or kind of on one general umbrella. What did life look like, and how did you decide to get into real estate? Was it always the path that you knew you were going to be on? Or do you even consider yourself to be in real estate, given the type of investing that you focus on at the platform level?
Yeah, I consider it to be real estate. It's a very specific industry. It's got very specific economic profile, if you will. What are the drivers, supply, demand, et cetera. So there's a certain skill set there that is real estate at its core. And what we do is, I mentioned these structures, we think is a better way to invest in real estate, but it's investing in real estate. So I consider myself a real estate investor. I had no designs to get into it. I was part of a tech startup in the 80s. I went back to business school, got out of business school in 88, which was interesting. Summer of 87 was the boom time on Wall Street. I worked for Salomon Brothers and did all that. And crash of 87 happened, and ended up at 4 job offers, went to 1.5. And, you know, the world really changed pretty dramatically, and ended up at a consultancy working on restructurings. There's a whole story there, but it's in short, it was a little bit disappointing to me, having worked at a big investment bank, but it turned out to be a really wonderful opportunity. And these were corporate restructurings. All the junk bonds of the 80s had gone bust. There's a lot of work to be done. That gave me a leg into Rothschild, which is where I started in the investment banking, and Rothschild Realty is the predecessor company to what Almanac is today. So joined them as an investment banker in 1990. Doing restructurings generally. And as all things investment bank turned out to be, my first deal was sort of a real estate deal. And all of a sudden, I was a real estate expert in the group and didn't quite understand what anything meant in real estate. But there was a group within Rothschild called Rothschild Realty, which had great expertise, was making investments. And so I would go and pick their brains when people were asking me certain questions, and I had no idea what a cap rate was and all sorts of things, and became great friends with them, ultimately joined the group. You know, John McGurk, who founded the group with the family and was with us until about 6 or 7 years ago, was a great mentor of mine, and I succeeded him as managing partner in 2009, but, you know, really joined him and started to become an investor. So, and as our banker who was trying to figure out, you know, what I wanted to be when I grew up, I started to gravitate towards the buy side, started to gravitate towards investing, making those investment decisions. It's been a lifelong journey for me, passionate about investing generally. It's a real estate investor, but the concepts, as you suggested in your question, are from within real estate, but many of them are from outside real estate. Almanac is named after Charlie Munger's book, for instance. We read, you know, Dodd Graham, all these, everything that's out there that is oriented at making good investment decisions has sort of been built into our DNA. And that's what excited me. That's what excited John. And so we started looking at the world through that lens. Of course, it was the real estate world, which is very, very different than it is today. But that's how we started. And that's how I got into the business. It was not by design, but more by circumstance.
You mentioned a tech startup in the 80s, and I'm curious to know, what were you trying to build?
Well, it was started out in my bedroom in college, and we were selling. At first, I was writing spreadsheets for large companies. I went to school in St. Louis, had a summer job in New York writing a spreadsheet. Lotus 1-2-3 had just come out, and so a lot of these large companies had no idea what to do with it. And so I would write spreadsheets. And so I did that. It was a service business. I started hiring people. I would write the spreadsheet. My fellow classmates or underclassmen would run them. And it turned out to be a pretty good business. After a while, I started selling them computers and merged my company with another company that was selling computers. And we were one of the largest resellers of IBM equipment in the Middle West, competing with about 100 companies, among which was Dell, this small little startup out of Austin. We couldn't quite figure out how they were doing their business. We poo-pooed it at a certain level. He did really, really well. We did really, really not so well. I had a great business school essay, but was and learned a lot about business, learned a lot about technology, learned a lot about all sorts of different things through that experience. It wasn't quite what I wanted it to be at the end, but it was, you know, one of the definitely a big foundation to my investing and to my career.
That's wild. That's awesome. Great story. I think there's an entrepreneurial spirit that I think is a theme throughout your career as you're building and innovating in the different business lines. And then, you know, when you were doing junk bonds, it's been a somewhat of a common, you know, theme, or at least around restructuring across some of my guests. I mean, when you look back at that time, what have you taken away, or kind of what were some of the kind of early lessons that informed your career, you know, post the Rothschild and Almanac days?
You know, so much. You know, you get to see a lot of people's mistakes and, you know, how good companies, you know, through bad balance sheets or bad strategic decisions end up in a ditch, end up in restructuring, you know, how they bet the company on certain capital expenditure programs, which does not turn out to be, and or they over-leveraged their balance sheet, or they didn't attract the right people, or they were poorly governed. There's like every day you're confronted with what not to do. You're also confronted with, you know, the legal aspect of what we do every day. We're deal makers. We enunciate a lot of what we do in trans, you know, in paper, in legal documents, both with our LPs, but with our companies, and living the sentences in those documents was really impactful. You know, you're in front of a judge and they're asking you about, you know, certain words and what they mean. You know, when you're negotiating a healthy deal, you definitely have that running through your brain of like, you know, and there is a difference between and or in this circumstance. You want to know why? I lived it. And that can be very impactful. So structure counts, also leverage counts, all those bad, you know, things that folks did or mistakes that they made, I could learn from and adopt to an investor's mindset.
So let's take that and kind of walk forward through your career. So when you started, I think it was in 1990, if I'm not mistaken, at least according to the background that I have at Rothschild. What was the original kind of thesis of the business, and how did you go from where you were to this platform investing concept, and specifically focused on real estate, at least in your case?
Yeah, well, look, I started out as purely investment banking, was in the corporate group, but doing more and more real estate. And by 92, 93, you know, was doing almost all real estate restructuring. And I talked to John McGurk about joining his group because he was like, it's a good book of business. You can continue on here and have more of a balanced life, which is, you know, something I was looking for after that experience. But he also said, look, there's all these REITs and this RTC stuff. Like, I'm a real estate guy. I don't understand corporate structures. You've just been like living them for the last 4 or 5 years. You know what they mean. Like, tell me if we can make money here. It was that simple. And so my first activity for him was to go out and sample the REIT world and say, you know, is there ways to make investments? And, you know, underneath it all was real estate. He could tell me, I could look at a company and say they own 12 buildings and this is what they are and this is what the NOI is and but what's it worth? And he could tell me what it was worth and we could look at NAV. And so we started to build this investment approach of like underneath it all is real estate, build a net asset value model for a company. It's much easier to do in real estate. I came from the corporate world where it was all the companies are public. There are no private assets. Here, 2% were public and 98% were private. So you had this incredible, you know, private market in which you inform your net asset valuation. And then let's look at the companies that are out there. The REIT boom that, you know, has started the REIT world as we know it today had just happened. There were 200 public companies. And so we sifted through every single one of them. And the first approach was to say, hey, we can buy dollars for 50 cents. Even I could do that. The first money into my hands is portfolio manager was from the Rothschild family. They put in $2 million and they said, you know, let's do long short. Hedge funds were much bigger then. It's a big idea. But that led us into thinking about, wow, there's these companies out there. Some are trading at a discount. Some are run better than others. Some we wouldn't touch. Some look really appealing. Some of them are shut out from the capital markets, and it's a capital hungry business. And in order to grow, you know, a company needs capital. And some of these companies that had gone public were trading below their IPO, couldn't access the public markets. And that's when the idea started to occur of like, hey, this trading stuff is interesting. We did really, really well, but maybe we should place capital into these companies, help them grow, sit on a board. I work for a merchant bank, a 200-year-old merchant bank. This is what they do. They put in, they provide a capital solution. They also provide intellectual capital to help the companies grow. And so we identified, you know, 10 companies that we thought we could approach. John had a relationship with a large state pension plan. And, you know, we ran out there and chatted with them and got our first $75 million in a fund of one. It was called Five Arrows Realty Securities back then. It's now called Almanac Realty Securities. We rebranded. And Five Arrows was a Rothschild operating brand at that time, and started to approach these companies with that in mind of like, hey, let's find the good companies. Let's go to provide them with a good capital solution, namely convertible preferred into their companies that they can draw down over time, that they can grow their balance sheet. But let's take a board seat. Why? We could watch over our investment. We can also help the company grow. We can be good partners. We're fully aligned. We're aligned. You know, we own a piece of everything they do. We're not worried about this building or that company or whatever. Let's help them and help them grow. And that should lead to a better result. So that was sort of the transition from I'm a corporate banker and all this stuff to making a very sort of concerted effort into the public realm and doing these pipes, as they're called today, private placements into public entities and playing merchant banker. And after a while, we started to reorient our sights on the private markets.
What year was that? When did you go kind of fully private market focused?
Well, we started doing these deals in 96. So the first long short fund was 94, then 96. You know, somewhere about, I think 98 was our first private deal. And we kept doing them till 2000, 2001. We did one in, you know, 2007. But for the most part, it's been private ever since. And primarily for the reason of there's only 200 companies. We identified the 10. We transacted with most of them. And 98% of the assets are in the private world. So if you're looking for scale and growth and for maybe, you know, better opportunity, shifting to the private markets, if it was going to, you know, if it was open to adapting this type of structure, seemed to make a lot of sense to us.
Interesting. Well, the private markets have certainly evolved a lot over the last, you know, 15, 20 years, not only in the number of players, but also the maturity. I think the governance and transparency has evolved a lot, although I think there's still a long way to go. If you, you know, let's kind of fast forward to present day, give us the overview of Almanac Neuberger Berman, the platform kind of size, scale. You've mentioned a few of the strategies that have kind of been present throughout, but what is the business that you lead look like today?
So at a certain level, it's very steady Eddie type of approach to the market. And at a certain level, you know, the fundamentals of finding good companies that are in growth mode, rolling them up, putting our money into those companies, sitting on a board and growing them and helping them succeed remains the same. Obviously gotten a lot better at it, I hope. We have a lot, you know, we learn from our mistakes. We also learn how to help our companies more and more. We see great benefit of that. We actually used to do ad hoc help, I'd call it, like, you're putting in a new MRI system, go talk to that CFO, he just did it. We've now institutionalized that in something called Almanac IQ, which is some resources and a team that's oriented at helping our companies. Again, we're aligned. If we can make a 15.5% IRR go to a 16 because we have a good capital markets idea or good use of technology or better financial planning, you know, it's in our best interest and aligned interest to do that. So, but it's really the same fundamental investing. Let's find these good teams. Let's find, you know, do a bottoms up analysis on who they are, what they can do. There's so many ways to make money in real estate. Different asset types, different geographies, different approaches that, you know, we're set up to find those types of opportunities. And there's more and more of those as time has evolved. 30 years ago, people in the real estate community were not really thinking this way. They weren't sort of thinking about a company. They were thinking, you know, really deal by deal. Now they're actually looking for this type of platform more and more. So that part of the business is, you know, evolved, but it's got the same underpinnings. The second thing that we've started to do in the last 3 years is buy into GP stakes of real estate managers. And that came out of some of the experiences we had in the flagship series. We invested in companies, how they capitalize themselves is really runs a gamut of, you know, families buying and holding forever, and they put 100% on the balance sheet, to others who take our capital and say, we'd like to use this as GP capital to attract either individuals or, you know, institutional capital and joint venture or other ways, and evolve themselves into an investment manager in many instances. So we saw the power of that. We saw the profitability of that. Meanwhile, when we joined Neuberger Berman, they had a minority stakes business that was a real innovator and market leader called Dyal that was buying into GP stakes, minority interests of private equity GPs. And we got to watch them very carefully and work with them on a couple of different things. And it occurred to us that there was a really good business there and a really good investment approach in terms of, one, a market opportunity. There was a growing number of investment managers out there who were seeking capital and needed a capital solution and needed a partner who could help them. And that we had a pretty good skill set relative to that. We obviously understand real estate underneath it's real estate and should never be forgotten in anything that we do. But we also understood what it was like to run an independent investment manager and what a LP list looked like and what it felt like and what the prospects for a GP was going forward, and why might that capital be needed, and how should it be used, and how to make that investment decision on who to invest in, but also to help them the way we've always helped our companies. And so that's sort of the second area that's sort of come out of, you know, all of our activity. And, you know, we think we're in the, you know, the top of the first inning on that one for sure, in terms of the business and how it's growing and the industry. And we think it's a really interesting time to be making those investments into those GPs.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with the differentiation, GP is often synonymous with, or at least in a colloquial sense, it's synonymous with, you know, operating businesses, the entity. I know it's part of a legal structure. And then you talk about investing in companies, right? Minority or majority ownership in platforms. What's the distinction between the GP stakes business and then the legacy kind of platform investing business? And then, you know, maybe let's expand upon some of the drivers of each that help kind of lead to specific opportunities.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's terms that are thrown around to identify these things, but at the core of it, they're both of these opportunity sets are companies. They're real estate companies. They invest in real estate. They have teams of individuals that are tasked to do that. They're also tasked to, you know, to operate the real estate in many instances. So there's a tremendous amount of overlap, and they're set up in a company where the people work for that company. They're, you know, how they work, how they're incented, how they're aligned with an investor and with management, et cetera, becomes all important. So, you know, the similarities are, there's a very long list and more than the differences, if you will. They are different in terms of, you know, how they are set up. A GP, and I've referred to them as a GP, is how the market refers to them, are investment managers. They're a company that's set up with people that set up to make investments, to operate that real estate, et cetera. And the primary source of their capital is not their balance sheet. It is third-party capital from limited partners, whether they be individuals or institutions or sovereign wealth, et cetera. And so those quote-unquote GPs operate a business as an independent investment manager and all that that entails. Some of them are registered, some of them are not, but it's while a lot of similarity to our flagship investments, it's a different business in terms of the economics of it. Real estate drives what they do. If they do great on the real estate side, they're going to have a great business. They'll be able to attract more capital. But if you look at the income statement, which is really the distinguishing point between these two, you know, their primary source of revenue is investment management fees and promotes that come off of funds. Our flagship investments have all the things that I mentioned that are similar, but they are more balance sheet investors, if you will. They might have some partners and some properties, but what they're really oriented at doing is buying property, putting it on their balance sheet, like a public REIT. A public REIT goes out there, they own a bunch of assets, people work for that company, and the vast majority of their assets are real estate assets. And they'll go out and buy more or develop more or sell some here, buy some there, joint venture there. But it's really a balance sheet activity where there's a company that's got, you know, that profile. And if you open up their income statement, the primary revenue is rent, right? So it's sort of how we distinguish in our mind what's sort of a GP investment manager model and what is a more of a balance sheet model.
You mentioned we're in the first inning, if you will, for the GP stakes business. And there's been a lot of activity, you know, a lot of news flurry. It seems like a flurry. How would you best summarize kind of where we are and then where you think the market will evolve to specifically on the stakes, the GP stakes side of things?
Yeah. So, you know, I think private equity is a sort of good, pretty good proxy for what we do. And we're maybe 10 or 15 years behind, you know, sort of the evolution of that business. And traditional private equity is, you know, these are called buyout shops. Now they're, it's called private equity. They buy into companies that are not real estate for the most part and, you know, raise a series of funds, et cetera. And, you know, that whole industry has evolved with a, you know, high degree of sophistication over the last 30 years. And there's businesses there that have proven to be going concerns. It's not just a group of individuals who are doing deals and raising funds, et cetera. They're real going concerns relative to their investor base, to their operations, to their investing approach. There are very good examples of that within real estate. Of course, there's, you know, there's Blackstone, et cetera, that have that private equity model, if you will, that are very, very sophisticated. But if you look at the penetration and the concentration on the private equity side, it's much more concentrated and much more evolved, if you will, than it is on the real estate side. Real estate is a huge industry. There's lots of nooks and crannies. This is one nook and cranny that's growing. It has a lot of wind on its back, and that is institutional real estate investing, if you will. And so there's a lot of middle market companies that are out there. Some won't make it, but many will. And there's great tailwinds for that business, meaning we're maybe at a trillion. It's grown at a 17% compounded for the last 30 years. Maybe it keeps growing at that or maybe 10, but there's still a lot of institutional demand for these types of services, retail demand for these types of services. And so when I say we're in the early innings, it's not so much of the industry, but of these companies have now evolved to a point where they are going concerns, very much like a private equity firm 10 or 15 years ago. There are succession plans in place. Those succession plans have been implemented. There's a new generation coming on. There's these businesses have, you know, grown more sophisticated. And so they're now looking for outside capital as opposed to self-funding to, you know, pursue their business plans, to evolve their companies, to make those succession plans, and to go into new businesses to better serve their clients. And so when I say we're in the early stages, one, you know, the minority interest aspect only hit private equity 10 years ago. And so people are looking at that now within real estate saying, what's that like and how does it work? But more importantly, those businesses are in a position where they're looking for a capital solution to succession, to growing their business, to being, you know, putting more money into their funds, et cetera. And that's creating demand for this type of capital.
I want to talk about what specifically you're looking for in a partner, an operating business, a GP, if you will. But before I do, you know, it's not lost on me that real estate as a institutional investment, you know, investable asset is relatively new, what, the last 20, 30 years, and is maturing nicely. I guess my question is, what are your investors looking for in a broad sense that's, you know, in investing with Almanac that's different than from, say, investing into a fund directly or directly into a separately managed account, a JV, or, you know, into an asset that they may own? How do you kind of think about the relative differentiation between the platform investing and the kind of asset investing? Where does it fit in a general sense?
Yeah, you know, it's one is just different. I mean, there is that aspect, which can be hard. It's like, we don't look like anybody else, but it's good from a portfolio construction point of view of like, hey, we really don't have anything like this in our portfolio. And we're accessing real estate opportunity in a very different way than traditional, you know, allocator fund or in a sector specific fund. It's just different profile, different expected returns and different, you know, volatility of those returns. So if you want to get specific about, you know, how it fits into their portfolio, that's how, you know, our institutions think about it. So we've held forth saying, look, we can provide you with a different way into real estate. We can access a whole different community of real estate operators that you may not have access through these other funds. They're just would not transact on the basis that those funds are looking for in terms of control of the properties, control of the capital stack, control of decisions. They're looking much more for a partner. They're also looking for somebody to help them with the people side of their business. If you're just investing in the assets, you know, the GPs in those instances, the folks either operating or investing that capital, 5 or 10% in, have a whole, you know, business behind it that they're seeking to capitalize. And, you know, yes, it's good to grow, but they're, you know, sometimes they would like assistance and help and alignment on that. So we talk to our investors and say, you know, look, we've got there's thousands of these companies out there, as you and I have discussed over time. There's many of them who would not want to transact on the basis that these other folks would, but they would with us. One of our hallmark features that we have when we invest is that we share control with our partners. And this is more on the flagship side than on the stake side, but, you know, what we're looking to do there is, you know, find best in class local operators that have been capitalizing their business, sometimes just internally or through friends and family that are looking to evolve their business. They have a great track record, you know, great depth of understanding, great suspicion of institutional capital relative to control. So we'll go in there and say, hey, let's build this business together. The trade is you put everything in with us. The other trade is that we're going to share control and, you know, we're going to build this together and we're going to think like partners. And so our investors look at it and say, hey, that's a very interesting way to invest. We also have our track record and our investment disciplines over time that have shown to be and proven to be very, you know, very attractive to them as well. On the GP stake side, it's the same thing as well, although a different flavor. We're saying, look, we're accessing real estate for sure. Underneath it all is real estate, but we're getting a different way to access real estate returns, perhaps fuel injected, because we're finding these great management teams, we're finding these great companies, and can do even better, not just by, you know, doing co-GP through the company into the funds, but we can also invest in their business. And you can get a higher return based upon that, which is uncorrelated to anything else you're doing. Many of our strategics are also looking at the GP stakes and saying, hey, what else can go on here? I have a great relationship with this GP. Maybe I should do a, you know, co-investment into their fund. Maybe I could do a co-investment into one of their buildings. There's a whole sort of ecosystem around what we're building on the AIM side that they find, you know, very compelling. And again, outside of what they could normally do with other, you know, product offerings in the market, and it fits very nicely into their portfolio.
And just kind of a few more details, and then we'll move to the platform side. You're investing out of predominantly closed end in the fund series. The platform fund series is closed end funds. Is that right?
Well, yeah, the platforms, you know, Almanac Realty Securities is a closed end fund series. You know, we have a 4-year investment period. We have 10 years beyond that to, you know, to grow these companies and realize upon them, et cetera, a fairly traditional approach. On the GP stake side, given the nature of the investment, and that would be perpetual. You're buying into a company. There is no put there. You're buying into it for perpetually, that we set up our funds to reflect that. So different profile.
One of the things that we've talked a lot about with past guests on this podcast, and something that comes up in a lot of discussions, is there are a lot of GPs out there. You and I have talked about this. You're right. Many times we have, you know, 2,000 on our platform, and that's a fraction of what actually exists in the market. And I think you used the phrase suspicion of institutional capital earlier. And when a conversation evolves, the very first thing that I often hear from our non-institutional clients is that they don't want to give up control. You're talking about shared control versus a control position, which drives that alignment. So let's assume kind of you've got all of that in a general sense kind of ready to go. Then what's the next level? How do you find firms that can truly differentiate themselves when you're thinking about enterprise value or value of the, you know, the operating business versus just the underlying real estate? What are you looking for? What does that look like from your perspective?
Well, you know, it all starts with the people. You know, it's people tend to think about real estate as, you know, location and bricks and doors and windows and, you know, replacement costs and things like that. But it's really a people business, and who's touching your building counts, what they can do with it. Somebody developing a piece of land, or are they a, you know, we call it, are they a placemaker or are they a moneymaker? It's two different things. You got to be both in a way, but some people just make places and they lose money. Will they make money from it? So who you're dealing with, what their track record is, what their approach is, how they've treated other partners, how they treated their banks. You know, there's a long, long list for us to put ourselves in a position where we're comfortable underwriting to shared control. And so there's a number of factors that go into that, but it's, of course, what have they done with real estate, their ability to create wealth for themselves and their partners? Have they built a team? How does the team operate? What's the longevity of that team? There's a whole long list of things that we look at, you know, relative to the partner that we're choosing. And this is, you know, obviously true for our flagship, but it's very much true on the GP stake side. Is this a going concern? Is there one person who's lording over everybody and not letting everybody grow and develop, and there's an obvious successor or not, right? So there's all sorts of things that you think about, you know, relative to that. Of course, there's the real estate, and it, you know, once you get past the people, you got to look at the real estate and say, do we like the real estate? Do we like what we're doing? Do we like the markets that they're in? And do your traditional real estate underwritings relative to demographics and Argus and all that. But it really, really starts with a very heavy underwriting of the people. And we talk to, you know, over 100, you know, opportunities a year, let's say, and track a lot more, and we'll get to two or three. And that's, you know, part of, you know, our discipline is to say, okay, you know, who are we making a decision to invest with, and what's the profile of that team and those people?
You know, when you think about how you get to know people, what does that process look like? I mean, so much of what we do in real estate is a people business, but understanding kind of what's behind these people is some, you know, there's no playbook. You can't read their CV or their LinkedIn. What does that really mean? How do you underwrite the people?
It's really building a relationship with them. Rare is it that we have a meeting and we will, you know, decide to make an investment the next day. I mean, it doesn't work. You build a relationship. You get to understand the team. They get to understand you. Our best due diligence, if you will, is, you know, we'll take the investment committee. We'll go visit wherever they are. We'll spend 2 days in a van traveling around. We'll get to see them in action with each other. We'll get to see them in action with their property management team. And there's, you know, little things that you look for and can sense about people and their team that, you know, when you're in an hour meeting, everybody's selling, right? So, you know, they're putting on their best foot forward, and they're presenting their company in the most positive light. And, you know, when you get behind the scenes, you really have to spend time sussing out, you know, those issues that you really just find by spending time with them. You know, we also underwrite the organization top to bottom. Once we're under, you know, due diligence, we'll, you know, we send in a team of people. They interact with, of course, the leadership team, but they'll also interact with, you know, the property management team, the accounting team, and we'll have a pretty good sense of what this organization's all about, how it operates, who the people are. If there are any issues, you never 100% know, but I think we've learned the, you know, over the years what to look for and, you know, what to bow out of. But it really, you know, gets to that. And there's also the call around, right? It's a small, big industry, you know, a quarter degree of separation, you know, for everybody in it. And so, you know, getting a sense of how have they treated their bankers, how have they treated other partners that they may or may have over the years. So I think that gets into it. And of course, we'll, you know, part of our process, you do a more formal background check if they've been to jail or things like that. never really pops up, but you got to do it just to make sure that you've dotted your I's and crossed your T's.
Yeah. I love the call around concept. I mean, the industry is so big yet so very small. And I always joke with our team, or don't joke, but insist that our team takes, you know, every interaction very seriously, and joke that if I had an investment fund and could invest in with people who are good to do business with versus those who aren't, it would probably, you know, outperform the market, all things being equal, just because, you know, there's the people do matter so much in our business, and, you know, your reputation transcends any one transaction. So I think that's a great point. What advice would you give to GPs who are listening, who might be really intrigued by this idea of, you know, either the platform or the stakes investing, but they don't, you know, they don't really understand institutional capital. They don't know how to find you and your team. They don't really know what it means to be quote unquote ready, but, you know, let's say they're good people and they've got a great track record and they've been in business for 10, 15 years. Kind of what are some of the logical things that they should be doing or thinking about to get on your radar or on the radar of people who are in the business, you know, similar to yours?
Well, look, I think, you know, there's a number of things that I would think about, and each company is just so different. I mean, even if you've been around for 15 years, doesn't mean, you know, some companies that have been around 5 years that might be ahead of you in terms of institutionalization or accounting or things like that. So I think the first piece of, you know, of observation would be sort of a riff off of that is like, you know, genuinely, who are you? And what do you want to do? And, you know, what is your company? And don't try to think like, oh, I got to tell the institutional guys this because they want growth, right? It's like, it's so easy to see someone comes in and they say, hey, we've been doing A, B, and C, but we want to do X, Y, and Z because that's what you want. And it's like, wait a minute. It's not what I want. I want you guys to do A, B, and C and do it well. And if there's great opportunity there, you know, tell me about it. If there's not, then, you know, tell me about that. You know, maybe we'll build a relationship and we can speak in 3 or 4 or 5 years when there is opportunity. So be true to yourself, understand your company. Don't try to outthink the institutional investor. It just comes off funny. And even if you do somehow succeed on that line, you'll end up in a very unnatural position for you and your team and, you know, find yourself in a funny situation. So, you know, so that would be number one. And number two is, you know, that being said is, you know, is listen to us and other people in the industry and see if that's what you'd like. We've had, you know, we're doing a transaction right now with a team we've known for 20 years and they've evolved and they're very entrepreneurial. Like 20 years ago, I was like, we were considering a deal. I'm like, wow, what were we thinking? We didn't do it. They didn't do it. It all worked out for the right, but we kept in touch and, you know, they evolved their business. They were, you know, they kept focusing on A, B, and C. They're very good at A, B, and C. So very true to themselves. They built a real team. They had to capitalize in all sorts of different ways, but they were really, you know, good at doing that and maintained doing that. And now they're sort of sitting here 20 years later and we have this opportunity. We've gotten to know them. They listen very carefully at a certain level of the things that we might think about. Including sticking to their knitting and running a great business. And you can underwrite their track record and it's very, very impressive. And so, you know, sort of iterating on that of, you know, being true to yourself, but also like now they have fully, you know, formed accounting. They do GAAP accounting. They have a capital markets person. They have, you know, very good reporting, et cetera. So, you know, I think there's that element of, well, of, you know, to summarize, like very true to yourselves, figure out who you are. Keep executing, not that the world will, you know, be a path to your door, but just keep executing, doing it well. And then when you have the conversations with institutional capital, if that's what you want, you know, listen to some of the things that they might need as opposed to what you think that they might want.
One of the things we've talked about in this conversation, it's come up in kind of the subtext is governance. And I think that's a big transition or inflection point when you go from managing your own capital or friends and family to institutional capital. What does governance mean for you? And how do you think about kind of underwriting the governance of the companies that you're talking to or investing with?
Yeah. So what governance means for us is there's really two things. One is it's less important until it's very important, which is the actual legal structure of a deal and some of the terms and some of the things along those lines. And you really only need them in a situation that isn't working out all that well. So, But the vast majority of times what governance means to us is a board of directors and a properly functioning board of directors. And there's a whole long list of what goes into that. But first is who's on the board. So it's generally someone from the management team, two or three people, someone from our team. And we have some senior advisors who help us out situationally. Some companies are more towards the beginning of their journey on, you know, building out systems and accounting. Some are very at the end and they're more about capital allocation, and you need to have the right people on the board. So board composition, also, you know, the board has the authority to make decisions. So that's good governance. It's not like somebody who's sitting on a board for an almanac as an almanac representative has to now go back to our investment committee every time we're making a decision. It's fully empowered people on the board making decisions for the good of the company, which is the third point, because they're aligned. What does that mean? Well, skin in the game. Our managers usually have a lot of skin in the game. And this is mostly in our flagship. There's a lot less sort of governance on the GP stake side. And I'll touch on that in a moment. But, you know, folks who have a lot of their own net worth and a lot of economic interest in the company. It's not limited to like, well, it's 5% and we go from there. It's like, no, tell me who you are, what your profile is, put the vast majority of it in to this company. And by the way, we're putting in a big slug of capital, probably a lot more than yours, but we're willing to share governance because you put so much in. And so you have this alignment that really kicks in as well of like who the people are, how it functions, you know, the empowerment of the board to make these big decisions. And finally, you know, the split board concept, you know, many of the lawyers and some of the theorists out there really don't like it. It's, you know, one person or another should have it. We take the opposite approach, which has been borne out over time. We have control in certain instances, but for the most part, we're saying, look, let's build a company together. No one party is going to be able to, you know, enforce their will. If things are going well, if things are not going well, you get into the paper and all that. But if things are going well, you collectively have to get along. You build a stronger company, you build a more, you know, enduring company, and you build a better relationship with your partner, which again is what governance is all about when you're on a board. And so all those factors, you know, working together, we think make for good governance. And governance, you know, of course, there's the theoretical of like, let's build a company, let's make buy decisions, make sell decisions. They're sort of the slow, you know, predictable, you know, pattern of a company building and then exit. But, you know, when, you know, June of 2020 comes along and you're in the middle of COVID, is really where good governance kicks in. You have to make decisions very quickly and in unison regarding your employees, regarding empty hotels, regarding debt, regarding all sorts of things, and could write great investment paper, but that will be absolutely no replacement for a well-functioning, appropriately populated, appropriately aligned board of directors.
Do you typically see groups create boards of directors post an investment from institutional capital provider like Almanac, or is this something that you would expect to see, you know, from the outset of your discussion? Because I'm just trying to think, you know, we haven't talked a lot about boards on prior episodes of The Distribution. And then also in conversations with customers of ours, it doesn't come up. And I'm trying to think, you know, do the majority of our customers have independent boards? And I know some have senior advisors, but I'm just curious to know kind of, you know, is there a gap between where the market is today and what you expect? Or how do you, you know, what's the reality here?
Well, I think the reality is that very few companies out there have boards. You know, if you look at the rest of the capital markets and other industries, almost every company has a board of directors. It's, you know, companies have been set up there in this format because of the alignment of interest, the transparency, the resiliency, but also the governance. I mean, governance is a huge part of a company and a corporate structure, a corporate board. Real estate, you know, it doesn't really have that. It has that in REITs, which is about, it's a huge sector. It's over $1 trillion in market cap, 150 companies. It's only 10% of the market. So the other 90%, it's really, there's some people who sort of have boards or have advisory boards, but, you know, not the full fiduciary boards that we think of and that we put together and that we have with our companies. I think there's a growing, you know, subset of private companies who do operate that way. But it's, if you look at the, you know, the thousands that we talk about, I think, you know, it's probably single digit that would have a, you know, your fairly typical fiduciary board that if you look at other industries, 90%+ would have.
Fascinating. Seems like there's a great opportunity for those without them to begin to think about that, which will likely increase, you know, the optionality that they have if and when there's a time for a capital transaction.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, our step back theory on the real estate business is that, you know, the starting gun was REITs in the early 90s. But, you know, if you, you know, project out 10, 20, 30 years, real estate will look a lot more like other sectors and other industries relative to this type of structure than it does today. I mean, you know, the REITs going from 2% to 10% is a huge shift. And the level and quality of governance and corporate activity there is incredibly high, amongst the highest in the industry. And there's going to be a lot more of that. And what we do is going to be a lot more of it. We see the demand side of it, not from investors, of which we do, but also from, you know, quote unquote, the GP counterparts. They're really hungry for this type of structure. It definitely will benefit them. And if the industry is going to continue to attract capital, you know, it really is better set up to do it this way than it is to do the traditional, you know, GP-LP structure, which is really a tax construct. I mean, this was a tax-driven industry up until 1986. You know, the tax indicators rule, because you gave me a dollar, I gave you $3 of tax benefit. It was very secondary what happened to the real estate. And that's how all these LP-GP structures got set up. And, you know, the industry is moving away from it. It's a huge industry. It's going to take a lot of time, but we're sort of in the, you know, middle third innings of it being adopted in our mind. But that's sort of, you know, the big theory, if you will, that we have relative to the industry.
Fascinating. Well, let's shift and spend a few minutes on kind of what other trends you see as you look forward. You know, one you just mentioned was moving away from tax structures. If you were to describe where you think the industry will be 15, 20 years from now, how might you kind of encapsulate what private real estate looks like in the future?
Yeah, I think, again, private equity is sort of like what we look at as sort of the model. It won't be perfectly like this. It's a much different set of facts and circumstances. But, you know, we see things will be articulated in terms of like large public companies. We see 10% going to 20, 30, 40%. The private side will be populated by companies, and it'll be venture capital. It'll be mid-market growth. It'll be, you know, large private equity into companies and platforms. And, you know, there'll be a lot of entrepreneurs out there still owning, you know, their own portfolios. But in order to compete, in order, you know, to govern and to attract capital and to, you know, keep up from, you know, as regards to technology and the environment, you're going to need to put yourself and compete with, you know, those larger entities and those more corporate entities. So we see the whole thing tipping in that direction. So 15, 20 years from now, we think it'll look much more like private equity with, you know, those monikers of venture capital and large public companies, as opposed to, you know, core plus, you know, things along those lines. And so, you know, we're sort of, you know, the business is evolving, and, you know, we'll sort of see it head more in that direction, and more institutional capital, you know, more things along those lines that'll move that along, if you will.
Do you think that this rise of private wealth will shift kind of what the market's looking for vis-a-vis what institutional capital is traditionally required? Or do you think it'll just be kind of the same, and the factor will be scale more than anything else?
Well, look, I mean, there's a lot of private wealth out there. It's will be another, you know, source of capital for an operator within the real estate sector. Some of them will form operations on their own, and they are. I mean, they're forming their own quote unquote platforms within, you know, a single family office or what have you. So, you know, it's certainly going to play a bigger role. But, you know, the non-institutional private owner of real estate plays a huge role now. It's, you know, 70 to 80% of the business. So I don't think that'll change. I think the sophistication of, you know, those wealthy families or those wealth channels will change how that money gets put to work, whose hands it gets put into attracting the investing your capital from a GP side. How do I attract that capital? You'll have to be much more sophisticated in terms of reporting, in terms of being a fiduciary, in terms of proving that you can outcompete the competition when taking that capital in and deploying it. So, you know, I view it as like, it's already a very large private sector in terms of where the money comes from and where it is. It's just going to be increasingly sophisticated. even out of the real estate families have been, you know, maybe accounting by checkbook for 50 years because that's the way grandpa did it. They're now looking to get a lot more sophisticated and bringing in, you know, outside operators and having to invest in technology because their buildings don't compete anymore, right? So they're sort of thinking about things differently in a much more institutional and sophisticated approach.
So the last topic I want to touch on is one you just mentioned, which is technology. And I know you have Almanac IQ. Right. You've always been very progressive in your approach to technology and digitalization. I'm curious to know kind of how would you describe your initiatives, whether it's Almanac IQ or kind of your approach to technology at the Almanac Neuberger level and or, you know, for the operating businesses that you invest into, kind of what do you do to help them? What's important to you? It's a deliberately vague question because I want to give you the space to riff on whatever's most relevant for you.
Well, look, we started talking about my early career. I'm a big technology skeptic. I've heard about AI since the mid 80s. I've heard about all this stuff since the mid 80s and, you know, tech booms and busts and, you know, who's going to be here tomorrow and the venture capitalists, you know, running out. And, you know, so I think along the, you know, over the years, we've been very skeptical about putting money into technology. Where we were most supportive of it up until about 5-6 years ago was reporting and accounting. No brainer. You know, there people were shifting over to GAAP accounting from tax accounting, you know, all the benefits that you get from putting systems in place, MRI, et cetera, as a real, and it may seem surprising, but not a lot of people had that 25, 30 years ago. So putting that type of money in was a no-brainer and you could see your payback. But everything else that we looked at over the years was very, very skeptical about, you know, relative to having our companies. We didn't have an Almanac IQ tech person because we were so skeptical. It was like, don't do it. You know, if it makes sense, let everybody else try and fail and then we'll adopt it because it'll be cheaper. I think our, you know, things have started to shift for us in the last 5 years again with a very sort of, you know, jaundiced eye, but with also a very informed eye. We were seeing our companies evolve and seeing some of the companies that we were meeting with saying, wow, they're using technology in a way that provides them with a strategic advantage when acquiring property, when operating property, and you're going to make more money with somebody who's got a very deep approach to technology than somebody who hasn't. And so there's been a sea change out there where the power of technology, especially in, you know, in areas that deal with a consumer that has a phone and you have self-storage and, you know, you don't need a person standing there 12 hours a day with keys to the locker. You can, you know, interact with them on the phone. You can price them on the phone. You can do a contract on the phone. You can let them into their building on the phone. They can go to their own unit on the phone. You know, your labor model's changing, how you're laying out your buildings changing, how you're interacting with your consumers changing. And that is, you know, dramatic for self-storage, which was a very, and is at a certain level, a very basic piece of real estate. So, you know, that's when we started to really put a lot of time and effort into helping our companies assess what technology to buy. We know some great venture capitalists in that business. We admire and respect them. We're, I guess, constitutionally unable to go into investments knowing we're going to lose money on 7 out of 10. We just don't like losing money. It's not in our nature. And they do a great job and I have great respect for what they do. But we looked at it from our side and said, no, I think the best way for us to help to enter this whole area of technology, if it's really being so impactful, is to help our companies be informed consumers, because there's, you know, 10,000 prop tech companies. You know, you get whiplash people approaching you about you should do this, you should do that, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, providing a good, calm insight to our companies, acting as a resource, sifting through the 10,000 companies and really helping them, you know, think through, like, is this just a toy and a shiny little object, or is this something that's going to strategically, you know, move our business forward in a very powerful way, in a very proven way? You know, now that that's available in the marketplace, I would argue it probably wasn't that available in the marketplace until 5, 6, 7 years ago. And that's how we should help our companies. And, you know, having them have that resource is not something they could do on their own. And so, you know, that's how we're approaching technology, being very aware, understanding the products that are out there, which can do what I just described, and helping them, you know, make the most out of their approach to technology.
I think that's a very appropriate way to play in the space. And I echo your sentiments of the maturation of the market in the last, you know, decade, or even in the last 5, 6, 7 years, and this importance around technologies that are must-haves versus nice-to-haves. It's an important distinction. And I know your team, and I know that they're doing a great job helping your portfolio companies in the market broadly. So thank you for that. Matt, I think we're out of time for today. If anybody wants to learn more about Almanac Neuberger or get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Call me. You can look on the website. We've got 6 partners. We have a team of 24 other individuals who work on the team. If you know anybody there, give them a call. But if nobody is familiar to you on that webpage, always feel free to reach out to me, and I'll get you to the right person and have the right initial conversation with you.
Excellent. Well, I've really enjoyed our conversation today. It's such a fascinating topic. I look forward to continuing to track it closely by watching what your firm is doing. And thank you so much, Matt, for joining me today.
Good. Well, thanks for your time, and thanks for all your questions.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter @B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.